Today is Tuesday, February 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Protests continue in Myanmar over the military's ouster of de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi.
People in Yangon chanted at police barricades on a road near the headquarters of Suu Kyi's party, the National League for Democracy. This just hours after night protests turned violent.
Plus, what's next for the opposition movement in Russia? And a look at a new musical generation. We'll have these stories and more next. People across Myanmar continued protesting a military coup on Monday and called for the release of the de facto leader of the country, Aung San Suu Kyi. This despite an increased show of force by the military and police. VOA's Arash Arabasadi starts us off.
Large protests continued into a third week in Myanmar after the military seized power and detained top leaders, including Aung San Suu Kyi, whose detention has been extended until at least Wednesday. People in Yangon chanted at police barricades on a road near the headquarters of Suu Kyi's party, the National League for Democracy. This just hours after night protests turned violent. Police and military forces recently increased pressure to end protests with shows of force ranging from rubber bullets to water cannons, with new reports of guns pointed at mostly peaceful protesters. Crowds lined the street outside Myanmar's central bank Monday, holding signs with the letters CDM for Civil Disobedience Movement. Protest organizer Tet Aung wants the country's banking sector to grind to a halt.
Civil disobedience movement must keep up momentum to speed up protests with less violence and casualties. Therefore, CDM in the banking sector would be the most effective way to disrupt functions for the coup administration.
The military, led by Senior General Min Aung Hlaing, has cited alleged election irregularities in November's contest won by the NLD to justify the coup. U.S. President Joe Biden recently approved sanctions against the country's top military leaders, but the military shows no signs of backing down. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
It's been nearly a month since Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny returned home following a lengthy recovery in Germany from a near-fatal poisoning attack he blames on the Russian government. While the Kremlin denies those charges, a Russian court has since sentenced Navalny to nearly 3 years in prison for alleged parole violations. Can Russia's opposition thrive or even survive without its leading figure? Charles Maines has that story.
New gestures of support, this time symbolic for Alexei Navalny. Since his sentencing earlier this month, Russian authorities have continued to ramp up pressure on the opposition figure. He was back in court last week facing new legal troubles. Meanwhile, thousands arrested while protesting in support of the jailed politician confront their own legal problems. Outside a Moscow prison, stories of filthy conditions for detainees and confusion among relatives seeking news.
I couldn't get any information at all. You call and they tell you nothing. And now only at midnight did I find out he was at the prison here.
Fear has become the government's primary tactic as it tries to keep demonstrators off the streets, with echoes of the Soviet Union's past treatment of political dissent.
We were waiting for our coup to take place. We were waiting inside the van, right beside the court. And there I read, I was fired from the institution where I used to work.
Navalny's attacks on corruption at the highest rungs of government clearly has the Kremlin's attention. But analysts say even Navalny's poisoning and protests after his dramatic return to Russia have failed to trigger any serious challenge to Putin's two-decade hold on power.
It's an extraordinary combination of events, set of events, that could, in theory, engender an extraordinary protest, wave of protest, but it hasn't.
Yet in the tens of thousands who have braved arrest and intimidation, Navalny's allies see a movement on the rise.
Only some are willing to go out onto the street because it's terrifying, but tens of millions support and sympathize with them. That's the new political reality we live in.
In fact, deep shifts are underway in Russia's urban centers, where President Putin's long-honed message of providing economic stability compared to the post-Soviet 1990s has diminishing appeal amid today's hard times, say scholars.
There's a change in values between the generations. To young people in Russia, the 1990s sound like the time of Napoleon. It makes no difference. It's in the past.
For some, Navalny represents the politics of the future. But polls suggest support for Putin remains steady among older Russians reluctant to change. For now, Navalny's allies have declared a moratorium on street rallies, with an eye on resuming them once again in the spring. Charles Maines for VOA News, Moscow.
The arrest of a climate activist in India with links to Greta Thunberg's movement has sparked outrage among politicians and the public. Reuters' Adam Reed has that story.
22-year-old Disha Ravi, a leader of the Indian arm of Thunberg's Fridays for Future movement, is accused of helping edit and distribute an online document from Thunberg in support of the ongoing protest by farmers across the country. A document that police allege spread false info. Thunberg had originally shared a toolkit on Twitter which listed ways to help farmers who have been protesting agricultural reforms. Ravi was brought in by the police over the weekend for questioning. Prem Nath is with the Delhi police.
The main aim of the toolkit was to create misinformation and disaffection against the lawfully enacted government. The toolkit sought to artificially amplify the fake news through various tweets which they have created in the form of a tweet bank.
On Sunday, a court ordered that Ravi be held in police custody for 5 days, sparking outrage on social media and among farm unions. Last month, thousands of Indian farmers overwhelmed police and stormed the historic Red Fort complex in New Delhi after tearing down barricades and driving tractors through roadblocks. Leo Saldana is a member of the environment support group in Ravi's home city of Bengaluru.
You can't just go into somebody's house, which is the most secure space for everybody, and pick up a young woman in front of her mother and say, you have committed crimes against the nature. Is our nature so frail?
A protest was being planned in the city against her arrest. Ravi could not be reached in custody and her family was not immediately available for comment. Thunberg says she had no comment on the detention of Ravi, and the movement in India said it was awaiting clarity from the police before making any statement.
Reuters reporter Adam Reed. The World Health Organization Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says the number of COVID-19 cases globally has now dropped for a fifth consecutive week and notes the number of newly reported cases is now at the lowest figure since October.
So far this year, the number of weekly reported cases has fallen by almost half, from more than 5 million cases in the week of January 4 to 2.6 million cases in the week starting February 8, just 5 weeks. This shows that simple public health measures work, even in the presence of variants.
The WHO has also granted emergency authorization to the coronavirus vaccine made by AstraZeneca.
Giving the green light for these vaccines to be rolled out globally through COVAX.
Reporting on the two Ebola outbreaks in Guinea and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Dr. Tedros says he's pleased that vaccination has started despite the remote location and general mistrust of outsiders in the region. Former Nigerian Finance Minister Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala received unanimous backing on Monday to become the first woman and first African Director General of the World Trade Organization.
The challenges facing the WTO are numerous and tricky, but they are not insurmountable. There is hope. There is light at the end of the tunnel. If we work together in a transparent manner that builds trust, builds bridges, diffuses political tensions, and encourages convergence.
A 25-year veteran of the World Bank, she ran against seven other candidates by espousing a belief in trade's ability to lift people out of poverty. And coming up later.
Ambient music is more relatable to like surrounding or like the environment. There's no like beat with drums or like acoustic instruments.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers say it's more difficult to fully observe the cosmos due to a problem called light pollution. Light pollution is the illumination of the night sky from artificial lighting like streetlights. A new study from a team of scientists led by the GFZ German Research Center for Geosciences suggests that streetlights may not be as much of a contributor to light pollution than thought. The scientists conducted an experiment with Tucson, Arizona, which utilizes so-called smart streetlights that can dim or brighten on command. For the experiment, Tucson officials would raise or lower their city's streetlights each night for several days and then maintain their normal brightness for 2 days after. The city was imaged each night by a satellite. The scientists found that only 20% of the imaged light came from the streetlights. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A new report finds internal displacement in the Middle East and North Africa has reached unprecedented levels a decade after the so-called Arab Spring triggered a political upheaval across the region. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
Over the past decade, the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center reports the number of internally displaced people in the region has more than tripled, from 3.5 million to 12.4 million. During the same period, it says 7.8 million refugees and asylum seekers fled to other countries in search of safety. The manager of the Global Monitoring and Reporting Team at IDMC, Vicente Anzalini, says several factors have precipitated this high level of displacement. These include foreign intervention in regional civil conflicts, local conflicts sparked by ethnic, tribal, and religious affiliation, instability caused by extremists and jihadist groups, and natural disasters. Anzalini tells VOA displacement peaked in 2015 when Russia intervened in the conflict in Syria and when Saudi Arabia got involved in Yemen's civil war. Another factor behind increased displacement in the region, he says, was the expansion of the war waged by Islamic State militants throughout Iraq and Syria.
And then a counteroffensive led by governments and by the U.S. and by Russia really intensified these conflicts. And many of these conflicts took place in urban areas like Aleppo, Mosul, just to mention a few. And then, of course, these urban areas were home to millions of people who had to flee.
Anzalini says Iraq is the only country in the region where the number of displacements has gone down. He attributes this reduction to the defeat of Islamic State militants, which has allowed many people to return to their homes of origin. However, he notes many returns across the region are being hampered by a series of factors.
Many cities still have unexploited ordnance and booby traps. So all these remnants of war need really to be cleaned up before people can safely go back. There are no good mechanisms across many of these countries to really support IDPs returning in a safely and dignified way.
If current UN-led diplomatic efforts in Syria, Libya, and Yemen yield positive results, Anzalini says fewer people will feel the need to flee their homes. But he says the outlook remains grim for now, and continued conflict in the region is likely to trigger new displacements. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A weekly newspaper run by a team of female journalists is thriving in Afghanistan's northern Balkh province, despite threats against journalists in parts of the country. VOA's Afghan service has more in this report, narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
In Mazar-e-Sharif, the capital of Balkh province in Afghanistan's north, the weekly Khurshid Balkh, or Balkh's Sun, covers local and regional news. The outlet run by all women shows they can work freely and without assistance, says founder and managing editor Neda Azizi.
I set up this weekly newspaper using my own money and continue to do so at personal expense. If there are any advertisements, that helps me, some of the costs.
Azizi works with two other female journalists. Together, they shatter cultural stereotypes of what a woman's role should be and still report despite a spike in attacks against media. 2020 saw a 26% rise in violence against members of the media, says the Afghan Journalist Safety Committee. The paper is growing more popularity, although Azizi says it can be hard to get people to pay for it.
I saw three or four places where they wanted to receive the weekly on a regular basis, but when we mentioned the financial cost, they did not want to buy the weekly. People want to read, but don't want to pay to read.
Good opportunities exist for women in this province, says Mathil Rahman Karimi, the province's director of cultural and information.
Balkh is one of the provinces where women have the opportunity to work in various fields, especially in media, where most of the employees of the public and private media organizations are women.
In Balkh, the province has one weekly newspaper and three radio stations run by female journalists. The number of females working in TV and radio is also relatively high. Rights activists say this helps elevate the voices of all women in the region.
What women face, what women go through, and the violence they face, men don't. That is why it is crucial for women to play an important and valuable role in media.
Despite security threats and cultural challenges, the journalists at Balkh Sun say they will continue to report on important and underreported issues. For Gulrahim Niazman in Mazar-e-Sharif, Afghanistan, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
U.S. President Joe Biden has signaled that his administration's foreign policy agenda will take a more conciliatory tone with America's allies and a sterner stance with her adversaries. To get one African expert's recommendations on what U.S. foreign policy toward the continent should be going forward, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Idiat Hassan, the director of the Center for Democracy and Development, an Abuja, Nigeria-based think tank dedicated to democratic accountability, peace, security, and transitional justice in West Africa. Ms. Hassan began by rejecting a top-down approach to foreign affairs, favoring instead a more bottom-up, grassroots strategy.
The traditional approach for previous administration has been to promote democracy through the state apparatus, but it has not been useful. So to counter this, we are encouraging the Biden administration to engage more collaboration between American and African news organizations, civil rights law firms, civil society organizations, youth groups, because Africans are open to multi-party democracy. They want constitutionalism, they want liberal values, and above all, they want rights, right. That's what Africans actually want.
What else do you recommend?
The U.S. should continue to impose sanctions on anti-democratic forces, but specific people, not one that actually targets the country. Uganda is an example of what happened during the last elections. We know that there were very senior military commanders who falsely imprisoned the opposition politician Bobi Wine for days and his wife, and he was not even able to exercise his freedom of movement. Those persons should be identified and sanctioned. The same for Nigeria during the NSAS protests. We know people who actually killed protesters, and they should be identified and sanctioned. But when sanctions are unilaterally applied on a country, it is the people who actually suffer, while the perpetrators travel to different parts of the world to enjoy their look.
Earlier this month, President Biden issued an historic memorandum putting the U.S. at, quote, the forefront of the struggle, close quote, for LGBTQ rights. Your reaction?
LGBT rights are human rights. But on the flip side, addressing LGBT rights as a cornerstone of the Biden administration policy has got the effect of pushing Africa into the hands of China, because a blanket promotion of LGBT rights is construed as being against the culture of the people as well as the religion of the people, aside from the laws which some autocrats have promulgated.
What about America's economic competition with China in terms of investments on the continent?
America does not necessarily have to compete with China in terms of investments. What it needs to do is emphasize people-to-people engagement, people-to-people learning, company-to-company, organizations-to-organizations, because soft power is able to tilt in the favor of the United States.
In terms of security, President Trump favored a very vigorous military approach, as opposed to a more humanitarian one favoring aid, for example. What should President Biden do?
The United States will have to refrain from a over-militarized approach on the continent. So if you look at Boko Haram, at the north of Mali, even ongoing in Mozambique, the heavy-handed approach allows for people to nurse grievances. More resources should be on winning the hearts and the mind of the people, while also addressing the root causes of some of this insecurity.
What was the reaction to President Biden's decision to nominate Linda Thomas-Greenfield to be U.S. ambassador to the U.N.? She was, of course, Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs under President Obama.
Many people on the continent was very excited. It means that there will be much more collaboration with African countries. People are not expecting that Biden will actually be doing many activities in their country. But looking at the UN and the kind of investment America will actually be putting back into the UN, it's expected to have impacts in our home countries.
Idia Hassan is the director of the Center for Democracy and Development in Abuja, Nigeria. She was speaking with my colleague Adam Phillips. Kenyan musician Kamaru grew up playing the guitar, but now he writes songs using kitchen utensils and car horns. VOA's Jason Patinkin rounds things out for us today.
If you mention the name Joseph Kamaru to fans of Kenyan music, they will probably think of songs like this. This song is called Gathoni, recorded by Kamaru and his band decades ago. Kamaru was one of Kenya's most famous 20th century musicians. He passed away in 2018 and is known for songs with jangling guitar, galloping beats, and wry, soulful lyrics. But these days, another Joseph Kamaru is making a name in Kenya's music scene. The younger Kamaru is the grandson of the elder superstar, yet his music sounds very different. This song is called Opaque, a track from one of the younger Kamaru's latest albums, Opaquer. To some listeners, this may hardly sound like music at all, but ambient music, as it's called, is a genre with a global following. And Kamaru, whose stage name is KMRU, is part of a small but growing group of East African musicians making ambient tunes.
Ambient music is more relatable to like surrounding or like the environment. There's no like beat with drums or like acoustic instruments. It's more of like the surrounding sounds. So for example, if I go outside, I can hear like a bird chirp, and maybe the bird like chirping has like a rhythm in it, and I can use like that rhythm. Or like different objects outside have their own rhythms or like patterns, which now for my music I use that as instruments and like build something which is a bit musical to listen to.
Kamaru makes his music by capturing natural sounds, and he points his microphone at just about anything. Drops of water, a squealing baby, airports intercom announcements. Kamaru edits and mixes all these sounds with electronic tones on a computer to produce songs.
When I'm with my recorder outside, when I hit record, it's like I'm already in the studio composing.
Kamaru didn't begin with ambient music. His musical roots are in his grandfather's songs, like this one called Charyaungi.
I bought like my first guitar, I think in 2012. And my direction of music was mostly like playing the guitar, the acoustic guitar. And also like from my grandfather's background, I used to go to his home and jam with him and play along together on some of his songs. He taught me like some basic chords.
But about 5 years ago, while studying music technology at university, Kamaru discovered electronic music. He's since performed festivals and concerts around the world, but he says his art is best enjoyed in more intimate environments.
Best context to like listen to like this kind of music, experimental, ambient, electroacoustic music. Lately I've been like diving more into like installation spaces where people can experience like different projects in like physical spaces or like art galleries or like museums, where it's more of like a sound sculpture or like a sound piece.
Says he knows around 20 other ambient musicians in Kenya, but he admits it's not for everyone. Even his grandfather wasn't a fan of electronic music. Still, grandfather and grandson had hoped to record some songs together. Sadly, that never happened, but the younger Kamaru is now working to archive and reissue his grandfather's songs. And while digging through the old records, he made a surprising discovery.
I came across like this record called Superior Japan, where he had traveled to Japan with like the president. And before the record starts, you can hear like the aircraft like taking off and everything.
Hearing these sounds, he realized there was a connection between his ambient music and his grandfather's rock music after all.
And this is like something which I related to, because I saw the connection he had also with the environment. Doing this project and listening to his words now, I think it connects.
But he says the most important thing he learned from his grandfather has nothing to do with style or technique at all.
I learned so much, for example, of just being honest. And it's more of like, not the practical side of like composition, but like knowing myself as an artist, and yeah.
And that's a lesson for any musician, no matter what instrument they play. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Washington.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well and be safe.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Guatemalan Congress is attempting to appoint an individual with serious allegations against him to be a constitutional court magistrate. The allegations include conspiracy to obstruct justice and evidence of past engagement with Gustavo Alejos, a former presidential aide whom the Department of State previously publicly designated for his involvement in significant corruption that undermined the rule of law in Guatemala. On February 1st, as a result of a case filed by Guatemala's public ministry, a judge issued an arrest warrant for this potential constitutional court magistrate for obstruction of justice. The connection with Gustavo Alejos is concerning. In 2020, the Guatemalan Special Prosecutor's Office Against Impunity exposed gross interference in the justice system. The investigation found that Gustavo Alejos, a Guatemalan businessman and former chief of staff to former president of Guatemala, Alvaro Colom, who is currently in detention for corruption, had set up a scheme to influence the selection process for appellate and Supreme Court magistrates. According to press reports, Alejos had contact with at least 41 people involved in the judicial selection process, including 10 legislators, two of whom are part of the current leadership in Guatemala. Accordingly, the U.S. State Department designated Alejos and his immediate family members as ineligible for entry into the United States in June 2020 for his involvement in significant corruption. In his official capacity as the chief of staff to former president of Guatemala, Alvaro Colom, Alejos was involved in undermining the rule of law and the Guatemalan public's faith in their government's democratic institutions, officials, and public processes. The Guatemalan Congress' attempt to appoint to the Constitutional Court an individual closely associated with Alejos and who faces serious corruption allegations calls into question the integrity of Guatemala's highest court, thereby weakening the rule of law and undermining a key U.S. priority for cooperation with Guatemala to strengthen democratic governance, said State Department spokesperson Ned Price in a statement. The United States is committed to supporting Guatemala's fight against endemic corruption and impunity, a necessary step toward the prosperous and secure future the people of Guatemala deserve. The fair and transparent selection of justices to the Constitutional Court is critical for the integrity of Guatemala's democratic institutions.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.